Welcome to the Family Story Podcast, where we talk about family relationships, important family events, and most of all, family stories that can be passed on for generations to come. I'm your host, Rick Jensen, and I'm glad you've joined us today. So sit back, listen, learn, and love as we talk about your family in this episode of the Family Story Podcast. Welcome back to the Family Story Podcast. This is episode 3 of interviewing Ernie Jensen, my grandpa. Last time we were with grandpa, he talked about his baseball days, and I want to go into a little bit more depth about that. My guess is that as a young man, it would be really difficult for you to keep up the baseball, but also having a job and trying to earn some money. So first off, I'd like you to tell me about your job. What was that like and what did you do? Later on, let's get into your illustrious baseball career as a youth, and let's hear about that and some exciting games that you were involved in. So let's talk about your job.
Lee McIntyre and myself had to run a sprinkler then 16 hours a day to keep the roads, the dust down on the roads because there's so much traffic coming this way. So we done that till fall and kept it all down for them. Then I think that next year they done that road through Pleasant View. And I worked out here on the Hot Springs sand pit and hauled sand down to the mixer there. They mixed all the cement there and hauled it in trucks over. Started from North Oregon and came this way towards Hot Springs. That's the year we started our ball team up with our younger guys. And
so here comes the conflict. Everybody has to go through a conflict between having work and having enjoyable leisure time. How did you make that work out in your schedule?
When Saturday came, I'd been working for about 2 months, I guess, and we hadn't started to play yet. And when Saturday came, I had to go play ball. I told him I wanted to get off to play ball. Well, you can't get off. He says, you're a steady man. He says, we can't get along without you. And I said, well, then I'll have to quit, because I said, I promised them guys I'd play with them, and I'm going to do it. He said, do you think that much about playing ball? And I said, I sure do. He said, okay, you can go. And he says, you got to have every Saturday off now? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, we'll arrange it. Go ahead then.
Wow. You must have been a really good worker. And it's very nice of your boss to work with you like that.
He was a pretty good boss.
So just out of curiosity, if you would have had to quit, how much would you have been missing out on? In other words, if it's not too personal, how much were you making at that time? What were your wages?
I was making $7 a day then. $3 for me and $2 a piece for the horses. That's the way they figured it. And of course, I had to feed the horses grain and keep them shod and everything. And I didn't make too much on them, but it was a job for the summer.
Well, that sounds like a great job for the summer. And you were able to have some leisure activity while you were at it. So that's wonderful. Good for you. How did this arrangement work out the following year?
Then the next year, they made a cut there on the corner by the Hot Springs. That's when that other road was coming through. I got on there and worked, and I got $8 a day for that. And we was playing ball all summer, but them fellows was good, and they'd let us off.
Being involved in sports takes a lot of time and even financial resources. Who paid for all that?
Them days, we had to furnish our own suit, buy our own balls and bats and catcher's gloves and things. But we did get a lot of support from the ward. Yeah, they'd come out and watch us every Saturday. That was pretty good. Nobody done anything on Saturday them days. Saturday afternoon, it was, if they had water turned, they turned it on the hay or someplace and come up and watch the ball game.
I think it's pretty interesting that you mention it's the ward, and it's really not a church or ward activity. It's more like a neighborhood or community activity. But I guess back in your day, there was only one ward, and they were the community. So that's kind of interesting.
And they used to follow us all around, too. And we played in the Farm Bureau League, and we was pretty good.
Okay, I can hear it now. It's time for a baseball story. Give us a great story, Grandpa.
One year, we almost won the pennant. We lost by one game. The next year, we won it. I'll never forget that as long as I live. We played all the teams around twice, but Slaterville. We played West Warren, and we beat everybody. West Warren hadn't beaten anybody. We played them 11 innings, 1-0. They beat us 1-0. So then we had to play Slaterville. They hadn't only been beaten once. We beat them. So they was playing for this chance to go play for the championship for South End of the Valley. It turned out to be Clinton. So we played them, and it was the ninth innings. The score was 2-1, in our favor, but we'd had our innings, the ninth innings, and they had their innings coming up, and one fellow got a little hit and got on first base. And then Floyd Cowan was an awful good batter. He was their catcher, and he was really good batter. And there used to be an old slough out there in right field. It made a kind of a short right field, but it was pretty good anyway. And he hit this ball out into that, towards that slough. And I run, and I jumped right in that slough and caught it. It really wasn't my ball because it was on right field, but I always used to back him up and both center field, or right field and left field. Now I'll always back them in case they missed it. And I jumped in and grabbed that ball and then throwed it towards second base so they could see that I'd caught it. And that gave us a championship of this end. And then we played Clinton for that, and we won that easy. We beat them 2 games out of 3.
I bet there were some hard feelings after that game. I bet they weren't very happy to shake your hand afterwards.
Oh, I want to tell you some more about that ball game. Over to Floyd Cowan. I used to go over there and get my hair cut once in a while, and every time I went in to get my hair cut, if there's anybody there, why, he'd always have to tell him about me robbing him from a home run so that he didn't get this home run and win the game.
So you scarred him for life. That's great. Let's talk about the next year. Was your schedule pretty much the same?
About the next year, Eli and I worked over on the North Ogden Road. We started to work on it right there, but North Ogden worked clear through to 5 points or to city limits. And I used to have a motorcycle, and him and I would go riding over on that to work. And when we got going up Dick Smith Lane, it was quite muddy one morning, and the motorcycle slipped right out from under us, burnt me on the leg a little bit. The thing was just singing and spinning there. I run, grabbed it, and shut it off. But we stayed with that job clear through to the end, and they got done. And then when we were through, we went and worked at the sugar factory that winter. Rode the motorcycle nearly all winter.
That's great. I'm sitting here in my mind thinking, I wonder if there's a difference between a motorcycle and a motorcycle. And it's just bringing back to mind the great accent that you have. I love it. Now let's change the subject a little bit. In 1918, the flu epidemic hit the country, and you were alive back then. Can you tell me any experiences of what it was like to live through that epidemic?
I'll tell you an experience I had is when the flu epidemic was on. My whole family was down with the flu. Aunt Laura Brown, she was the only one, her and Orrin was the only one up in their family, and she had them down. And we had the doctor came out there, Dr. Mills. He says, Ernie, you've got some sick people here. He says, you've got to watch over them. And I says, I'm in here all the time doing whatever I can for them. And so he said, well, we've got to have some medicine from town. Can you ride in on your motor and get it? And I said, you bet.
So they trusted you with that motorcycle then, huh?
So he called up. Dad had a telephone then. So he called up and Dr. Driver. And when we got in there, he had it all put up for us. And I just run up there along the side, and Orrin jumped off. He was with me, and he jumped off, run in, got the package, and we run back out. And one of them was castor oil. And so he gave him a teaspoonful of castor oil, each one of them. And he says, now in about an hour, give him another one. And when I went to give it to him, well, I looked at that little spoon, and I thought, gee whiz, that's not big enough for anything. So I went and got a tablespoon.
Oh, dear.
I give him each a tablespoonful, and about another hour, I give him another one.
Oh, no.
And brother, that night, did I have a job. I had all the pots and buckets, old buckets I could find. The next morning, they'd keep talking about the dead. They could see the dead on the walls, and about had me scared to death. Next morning, Aunt Laura come over, and she said, oh, Ernie, open the door. She said, it stinks so bad in here. She said, it stinks like an outhouse. I said, this was an outhouse in a hot house last night. And here come Doc Mills in a few minutes, and he said, oh, boy, he says, they look good today. What'd you do? And I told him, I can still hear him laughing, and he just got the biggest chuckle out of that. And he said, you're a pretty good doctor. And he says, stay with them. It went on, and they got better, all of them.
All thanks to Dr. Ernie. Way to go, Grandpa. Tell me, how did work continue on during that epidemic?
That year we had 2 acres of potatoes, and Dad had contracted them for stores in town, and we had to deliver them. Of course, I had to start in on the potatoes, and I was alone. Finally, my sister Lena got so she could help me, and then Roy got so they could come and help a little bit. But I had to load those potatoes in that beat the wagon and haul them over and weigh them out and deliver them to these places. After I got them done, well, then I had to come home and start digging beets. And Dad, he never did get out to do much that fall because he was really bad. And then he had that asthma, too. It was hard on him. But Lena and Roy got out and helped me. And we finally got most of the beets up. And then it rained and snowed on us, so I had to hire Russell Taylor came over and helped me, and we topped the rest of them in with hip boots on, snow, oh, and mud and stuff. But we finally got them all out and just got the last ones done, and it froze. That next night it froze, and so we never would have got those beets out from then on.
Sounds like you were blessed to have that income.
The next summer, I worked around odd jobs here and there, and finally got on out to the hot springs when they was doing that road, new road through there by, on a 89, I guess it is. And I remember working there, helped put up that cement deal they had there to mix their cement and green their gravel and stuff. And I stepped on a nail on a board, and it went through my foot and just pushed the skin up on top of my, above, just above my toes. So the guy, boss, come and pulled it out. He says, oh, what do we do now? And I said, oh, nothing. I said, I'll just keep on working. He said, well, we'll give you an easier job. We got to put all these conveyors, buckets on. He says, you and your buddy, Ryan Brunson was living with us, and he says, you and your buddy, go do them. He says, you get up there and sit on that platform and just turn that for him, and he'll bolt it on. Oh, for a week, that's all we've done. And, oh, did that ever get tiresome, sitting up there just not doing anything, not moving around? Finally, my foot got so I could go, and we worked around, and I could do anything. And after that, stayed there most of the summer.
Now we're getting closer to the time where you're going to meet your bride, but you haven't told us anything about other relationships you've been in. What about flirting? Tell us about that.
And in September, why, this Johansson I was telling you about, him and his wife was living on 2nd Street there, and he finally passed away. He was sick for about a couple of months, and he finally passed away. So his wife and three little kids had to move back to Idaho. They had a place up there, and so they're going to ship his body up. So Dad, him and my sister took all they could load in there, and the three kids and her, and then they loaded my Model T up in the back seat and just full as it could go. And then I was going up the next day. I had to work that day. It was my last day working, and I had to, and we went. And so Claire Gould, Stern Anderson, and myself went up in this Model T to take this stuff up for the funeral. So we went around Lava Hot Springs. He said, oh, let's go in here and take a bath. And I said, okay, well, I've been in this place. So we went in, and there was two girls there, about 18 years old. Boy, they was pretty little things, and they could swim and dive and do anything. And so they come over there, and I guess they worked there or something, but anyway, they came over and started talking to us, and they started diving off, and they started playing back out. Of course, we followed them for a while. First three dives, they took off, all three of us, and then the next two, they wouldn't follow them, so I did. They went clear up as high as they could. That must have been 16 feet, seems to me like. It was a long ways, and they dove off, and they just went under the water right out. And I dove off, and I went clear to the bottom and hit my hands on the bottom and almost broke my wrist. I come up, I thought I never was going to get out of that water. It just seemed to me like forever. When I got up, they said, what'd you go so deep for? And I said, oh, I wanted to see what was down on the bottom there. And they said, what is it? We've never been down there. And I said, oh, nice little pea gravels. I said, there's all colors of rocks down there.
That sounds like a lot of flirting going on there, Grandpa. That's what I'm hearing.
So anyway, we got out, then we went over and had something to eat. Then we went over the hill. They used to go over the hill, and so we just decided we'd go over the hill, and it was quicker to get there. So when I got, we got over there, why, a dad and sister was over to August Hansen's place. That's a brother of Joe's, and so they were staying there. So we went over there to see how they was and everything. So Cern, he says, he introduced me to my wife, and he says, Ernie, this is Vivey. And I went over and shook hands with her, and I says, well, you're going to be my wife. She says, oh, you dang fool. And went on, you know, and we never paid much attention to it that night. We went on over and went to bed then after that.
Okay, so hold on here. You're telling me that you met your wife and told her she was going to be your wife right after you were finished flirting with some other girls. And now you're flirting with the woman who you're going to marry. Wow, Grandpa, you are flirty.
The next day, she was singing in one of the groups that was singing for the funeral. I sat on the first row, and I'd keep looking up at her, and I'd wink at her, and she'd duck her head, and I'd wink at her again, and she'd duck her head again. That night, I took her over to the lava hut, or the soda springs, to have some of that soda water. I bought some lemons and some sugar, and we took a spoon and some glasses with us, and we was mixing this soda water. I had a flashlight, and she turned that flashlight right into my eyes, and I said, "Don't do that, honey, I can't see nothing." And she says, "Right now, I knew I was took."
So all of that flirting actually did some good. It got you to where you needed to be. That's awesome.
So we went home that night, and the rest of them went over and went to bed, and I stayed with her till about 1 o'clock, and Lena went to bed about 12, and then the next morning, I was over there for about an hour, and then we came home, and started writing to each other.
Oh, Grandpa, you're romantic. Wouldn't it be great if we had some of those copies of the letters? How often were you writing?
Sometimes we get 2 letters a day. And so when I decided to want to get married, so I just wrote, told her I'll be up one of these days to get you. I didn't even ask her if she'd marry me. I just told her I'd be up and get her.
Okay, I'm taking that comment back about being a romantic.
So Dad says, "Well, why don't you go Sunday instead of Monday?" He says, "We save a day there, and we got to get that roof on that house." He was building a house over town then, he was, and Claire and I was helping him. And he said, "If we don't get that roof on, why, it'll spoil all our work." So I said, "All right." And we went up there, and we took our instruments with us. And when we got up there, why, we went to Mutual that night with him. And they decided we had to have a dance Tuesday. So Vivi was playing in her orchestra, and her dad and her 2 brothers and another drummer they had there, and they had a little orchestra. And we sat in with them, and so the first 2-3 tunes we all played, and my sister played the violin, and Claire the trombone, me the trumpet. And so it went on, and then we'd start to go down and dance some. So we always had about 4 or 5 playing there all the time. And they brought us wedding presents, and they were nearly all big silver tablespoons. I never seen so many tablespoons in my life. And Vivi had a set of dishes that she'd got for herself. So we shipped all that stuff down. And the next day, we came on down to Ogden. I had to play for a dance that night. We'd started up another orchestra, me and Claire Gould and a couple other boys, and we'd started up another orchestra. So I had to go play for a dance that night. Next day, we went in and got married. And we stayed there. I had to go the next day and help all this gravel and stuff. So the next night when I came home, my mother, she'd moved Lena out into my room that I used to have, and they'd give us that big room on the northwest corner of the old house. So about 3 days, they had an auction sale over town on some furniture, and Dad said, "Let's go over." So we went over and he bought us a stove, the range and the table, couple of chairs, and Mother would give me my bed. And Vivi had quite a few things so put on it.
Well, of course she did. She's Vivi Jensen. That's what she's known for.
But anyway, they give us this bed, and so we set up housekeeping right now. This was homemade table, but I got after it and planed it down, cut the corners off, and really fixed it up, and we were just as comfortable in there.
And that's where all the love started. That's where it all bloomed from, right there. You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting is to see what a great example your parents are in helping your love to flourish. They did so much in supporting you, and I just think that's a great example.
The next summer, I run Dad's place on half, and we made about $400 outside of our living and stuff. We had some chickens that we were living on, and that fall, we started to build a house over there, and Vivi's dad came down and helped us too, and between the 3 of us, we got the house built, and we got moved into that, and then we was real comfortable.
And there's the other example on the other side of the family where the parents are very involved. I just think it's great. Wonderful. So let's talk about your professional career. Now that you're married, a job is a lot more important than just a summer job. What kind of things did you do to bring in financial income?
I worked at the sugar factory that winter then, and then the next summer I got on working for the county and driving truck. The first job I'd done was this old big old culvert right out here in front of my place now. I had to put that in, help put that in. And I remember a guy come out and said his back hurt and he couldn't drive truck, so they put me on driving truck. And then I'd eat dinner. I'd stop and eat dinner with Bobby every day, while I was working out here. And we was hauling gravel on this road up in front of our place here now, shaling it. That fall, we was only hired for the summer, but that fall they kept me on, and I worked right on straight through all winter and plowed snow with them. The next summer, they put me on, I helped overhaul the trucks that winter, and they put me on a grader then the next spring, and I stayed with that for 2-3 years, and then I went on to a drag line, worked on that for, I'd say, 4 or 5 years, and this ditch out here, this 6 mile, I straightened that out and dug that up through there about 45 years ago, and we cleaned it out here this fall. That's the first it had been cleaned out, part of it, and cleaned out since I dug it through the old Shelton place there. But I worked, then I went into the shop and was their mechanic for 3-4 years, run the shovels, the drag lines, the shovels, and the caterpillars, and graders, and everything else. And when the Republicans went off, I was in there working mechanic then, and I'd had one drag line tore down, and I'd been working. I started to work for the Democrats, and that's what I am, is a good old Democrat. And when the Republicans held me over because they needed some help there in the plowing the snow and stuff, and I was experienced in that. So when we got Democrats come back, McIntyre come up and he says, "Ernie, we're going to keep you on," he says, "because," he says, "you know how to do a lot of this work and plow the snow." I'd plowed snow for him up there and cleaned his place out to good. So he says, "We're going to keep you on." He said, "I want you to get that pile of junk over in the corner and throw it out." I said, "That's one of your drag lines." He says, "How come?" I said, "I got it all tore down, cleaned up, new parts put with it now, and ready to put it back together, ready to go back together." He says, "Who's going to put it together?" And I said, "Well, I was." He said, "You still are." He said, "If you can put that back together, it's your job." So I put it back together in about 2 weeks. Came up there, I had it all together and was out trying it out. And he said, "Where'd you get that machine?" I said, "That's a pile of junk in there." He laughed. He says, "Well, that other drag line needs overhaul. Can you do that for that?" And I said, "Yeah." So I just paid them, took this one out, gave them this drag line, and I went and got the other one and overhauled that for them, fixed it up the same way.
Now, this career actually led into your more permanent career as fire chief. Can you go into detail on how that came about?
That winter, we was out plowing snow, and one of the trucks got on fire. Seth Murdoch was running, and he had a ladder, and he let the gas run over, and it set on fire, and we tried to get the city to come out. That's when they was taking care of them first, and they wouldn't come. And I kept, finally, I started coaxing the commissioners every time or two, wanted to buy a fire truck so that we wouldn't have that happen again. And finally they did, and they called me in one day and wanted me to, what I thought about it, and I told him, I said, "We ought to have one of the tanks on so you could have some water." I said, "We don't have any water." So they got the county fire chief up to Salt Lake County Fire Chief. We worked out a deal there where we could have a 500-gallon tank back truck. It finally came on, it was the 1st of June, and they called me down to the office, and they said, "That fire truck is down to Salt Lake. Would you like to be fire chief and take it over?" And I said, "Well, yes, I can." I said, "Well, how did you want it worked?" He says, "You'd have to be on, live right, we're going to build a new fire station for you, and you'd have to live right there. 24 hours a day, you'd be on duty." And I said, "That's all right." And so they will give you your house rent, lights, and everything. And he says to me, how much do you think I'll be worth? And I said, 180. Well, he said, we was going to give you 175, but we'll give you the 180. So it went on, and I had to stay up there in a trailer for about, three or four miles, just before Christmas. And so I lived there in that trailer house and took care of the fire department there. Then we moved out on 12th Street, and around Christmas, I got my wife and then moved over into it. And that's where we lived for, 8.5, 9 years, something like that. And then that's where Rex was born, our youngest boy. He's born right in that middle room in the fire station there. So he's a fire station boy.
Boy, that's pretty cool. Not many kids could say they were raised in a fire station.
But it went on, and we worked there. I was doing their overhauling, their welding and everything for them then, and in the daytime. And then I'd take whoever I needed on a fire would go out with me in the daytime. Then at night, we had four volunteers there, and I had a bell in their house, and we'd ring that, and they'd come go with me. Then they finally got steady work, so we hired two men to come and stay right there nights. And then they'd grease the trucks during the night. They'd grease the county's dump trucks and stuff like that. So then it got to where I had to have another truck that was getting too much, so I got them to buy me another truck. And that's when Art Brown and Elmer Carver went in. So then we was getting crowded for room, so they decided to let me move out and go on 24 and 24 off. So we done that. That gave me a little more time off. Then when we got going that way, it was too crowded there with that, so I finally got the commissioners to build another lean onto that, or another part onto that fire station. I worked that pretty good. They come out there, and Art Brown was against it, so I says to the, put that one truck out away from the wall just a little bit. It used to get so close, we'd almost scrape the wall getting in, so they'd have room to get by them, to get out. So we did, and we got a false alarm, and then I run to answer the phone, and Ted, he started to go through there, and he couldn't get through. The commissioner was standing there, so he had to run around and get clear back through the shop and around to get back there, see? And so one of the commissioners says, Ernie needs more room here. I make a motion that we build him another fire station. And so commissioner then says, come on in, meet with us at our next meeting, Ernie. So I went in, and we drawed up plans that we thought we needed and won, and then we let it out on bids. Then when the bids was open, they called me in, and I went in, and this guy, we questioned him. He was a little bit, and we questioned him on what he could do, and he said, yeah, I can do just what you want there and everything. So we give it to him. When he got the fire station finished, we had room enough then for four trucks, and we'd got four trucks, and we had two brush fire trucks and two big ones. And that way, while we could take care of these fires on the hills.
Listening to your story, Grandpa, is really interesting because it makes me think about leadership skills. I once heard it said that a manager can manage people and make sure the job gets done, but a leader is someone who can find problems and fix those problems, and so that you can be more productive. And that's exactly what I'm hearing here, is you're quite a leader.
One time I wanted a brush fire truck, and Commissioner Hess was in it. He says, well, we can't afford it. We can't get this big truck up there on them hills. I said, it just won't make it. We need a four-wheel drive. So I knew a fellow over at the Dodge Company. Well, it's this way here, Jensen from Plain City down here. And I says, bring that four-wheel drive Dodge out here, and I'll get the commissioners out and look at it. He brought it out there and set it there, and I got him out there that afternoon, and they looked it over, and they says, well, that's not a fire truck. I said, no, but we can build it the way we want it, and we'll have a good outfit. So they said, okay, how much is it? And I said, it's $1,300. He said, okay, we'll buy it. So they bought that, and I built the tank on it myself. And we fixed it all up, and we had a real good grass fire truck. We could go any place with that thing, and just climb right up. So it went on
for about 3 years, I guess. Well, it was while they was raising the dam and things up there, and they had the road shut off, so we had to put something up in the valley. So we took this smaller truck up there and was going to let them take care of that until we could get up there. And they got out on a fire, and the pump quit them or something, and they couldn't get it going, and they let the truck burn up. And so that was the end of that. Well, then we had to get another one.
Yeah, I can hear the frustration in your voice. Tell me, who exactly did you serve with your fire trucks? What was your jurisdiction?
We really used to have a lot of fires. We used to take care of all of Weber County and help Ogden City. We'd go out and help them lots of times on fires, especially grass fires. They'd call us all the time on them because we had some good equipment to climb those hills and stuff and places they couldn't get with their big trucks. But now they've got stationed out in Uinta, one in Riverdale, one in Roy, one down in Hooper in Canesville, this one over here in far west, one out in North Ogden, one in the valley. In fact, they got two in the valley. Huntsville has a small outfit with a truck on there too.
You know, Grandpa, while you're sitting here talking, a great quote comes to mind. It was written down by Chris Musgrove, and he says, "Success is not measured what you're leaving to, but by what you are leaving behind." And you certainly left behind a great legacy for these firefighters in your past to follow. So thank you very much for that service. I still want to talk a little bit more about leadership, because you had some other opportunities in your life to do some great things. One of those opportunities was to serve within the church when you were called as a member of the bishopric. You said in your own words that as they made that calling and extended that to you, they could have knocked you over with the stick because you never had an opportunity to serve a mission or anything like that. And so ecclesiastical leadership was something new to you. But clearly, you were blessed with those skills for many reasons. And one of those reasons was to not only lead your family, but to lead a congregation in the Far West area. Tell me what it was like to receive a calling like that. How did that all come out? How did you respond when they extended that calling to you?
I said, "You don't want me." I said, "You want somebody that's been on a mission that can do that." He said, "This is your mission. We're calling you on." So he says, "You go home, tell your wife, talk it over with your dad, brother, and pray about it, see what she says." And I said, "Okay." And I was in the elders' quorum then. Jim Davis was president. I was the second counselor, and we'd get along pretty good, and we'd had some pretty good times together. So I went over and told my dad and mother, and they thought that was grand, and they said, "You do it." So we prayed about it, and the next morning, I said, "I'm going to do that." I said, "Maybe I can't, maybe I can, but I'll make a try at it." So the next morning, he came up. That was on a Monday when he'd done it, and Tuesday, here he came. And I got off in the drag line, went over to him, and never waited for Lou to come. And I said, "I guess I'll take that job." And he says, "I knew you would be into the state prison tomorrow night, and we'll interview you." So I went in, and they asked me a lot of questions, and I could do everything they'd asked me for, I thought, and I'll try it anyway, I said. So they said, "Okay." So in about 2 weeks, they organized the ward out there, or the bishopric, the new bishopric, put us in. And at the time, Jim Davis was the ward clerk for the other bishopric, and so hadn't picked a clerk yet, so Bishop says, "Well, we'll do that as quick as we have our meeting, first meeting." So we hadn't had a meeting yet, and on the Tuesday night, that's when the bishopric used to take charge of the mutual, the first part, and then turn it over to him. Bishop, he gets up and takes charge the first night, and Tuesday night, and there wasn't too many people there then, and so he got by good, and so Sunday night, it's your turn. I had the rustless speaker and everything else, so I had a pretty good speaker for him, and so I got him, and when I got up to make the announcements and stuff, I says, "If you can hear bones rattling," I says, "think nothing of it, because that's my knees here back of this pulpit." And of course, I got a laugh out of everybody. And Riley Taylor was sitting down, and he says, I felt sorry for you when you first got up, but after you made that little speech you gave, he says, why, I knew you'd get by then, he says, because I knew you could handle things then. So went on, but I never did really get over it so that I didn't shake a little every time I got up. And I was awful careful how I'd have to say so I wouldn't have to eat it.
Right. Leadership, there's a lot of growth experiences that can happen in it. It sounds like this was one in your life. And there's also some problems that can happen where, as the leader, you need to take control, and not everybody likes the way that you take control. Can you tell us about some of those difficulties you might have had in your leadership experience?
We decided to pull all those big old trees out there just south of it was WPA time then, and pull all those trees out and get rid of them. And so I said, we're going to pull those trees tomorrow night. And Henry McIntyre jumped up and said, no, we're not. He says, we planted them trees and we're going to keep them trees there. Well, I said, well, I'll have to back down then, I guess, until I can find different. That next night, we got a real good twister from the east. Knocked about four of those trees over, put one on the old hall, so we had to patch it up a little bit. The next Sunday, I said to Bishop, let me take charge again. I got up and I said, this time we're going to pull those trees over, because I said, the Lord's helped me out. I said, he helped blow them over. I said, I want four teams, 20 men tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, and we'll take these trees out. 6 o'clock, I had four teams and about 30 men there, and everybody was there to help me out. We pulled all those old trees out and got rid of them, and then we planted lawn and a new set of trees in there. So, you see, the Lord, he'll help you out if you pray about it.
And you know, Grandpa, there's something about you, too, that helps people to move along. In this day and age, we have so many talks on leadership and how to become a good leader. And one of these that I'm thinking about is by John Maxwell. And he says, leaders who leave a legacy of succession do the following. They lead the organization with a long view. They create a leadership culture. They pay the price today to assure success tomorrow. They value team leadership above individual leadership, and they walk away from the organization with integrity. And that's something I see in your life. You did this in so many different instances. And as your grandson, I'm grateful for it, that I can listen to this and think, wow, you know, he was really a great leader. He didn't have all these leadership talks or skills or classes, but as somebody who was blessed with this ability to lead others and to help them to grow. It says something about you. I appreciate that. Using your talents and skills in the work of the Lord is something that all of us need to learn how to do more effectively. You have so many talents and skills, but one of them is to build things and fix things. And it just so happens that while you were in the bishopric, the church needed to be remodeled. Tell me about that.
We remodeled the church a little and got that all straightened up, so the stand used to be up where it is now. But there wasn't any place for the choir the way they had it, so we put it down and fixed it so the choir would have their seats up there. We had a big, pretty good-sized choir then, and there were some real good singers, and they'd done real good on it. But we worked on that. We had to have water there. They didn't have any water, so we dug a well there. I mean, we'd go there and work at nights on that well till 12, 1 o'clock at night. And finally we got down and got us a good well, and that's the one we're using there now to water the lawns with. We dug that well and used it for culinary water for a long while, and then when they got the city water, why, we just use it now for pumping on the lawns and stuff. It cost too much to water with the city water, so I got Owen and myself and Calvin, we put this in so we could, and got this other pump and put it in so we could have the water there for the lawn.
And isn't that amazing? They use another one of your gifts, because one of your gifts is you could witch a well. You could bring water up from the ground because you could find it easy. I remember you did that for my parents' house. Well, Grandpa, thank you for joining us for this segment of the Family Story Podcast. We enjoyed learning about your leadership skills and the confidence that you displayed not only in your leadership skills, but also in finding a wife and how that all came to fruition. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. This concludes segment 3 with the interview with Ernie Jensen, and we may have another surprise segment coming up for you. We hope you join us again for another story on the Family Story Podcast. Thank you for joining us today on the Family Story Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. The Family Story Podcast is a production of Harmony Audio Recordings. This podcast is strictly prohibited for use without permission. For more information about Family Story Podcast, or to create your own Family Story Podcast, contact us at familystorypodcast.com. We hope you join us again soon and encourage you to go create a family memory today.